Welcome to Soundprint. I'm Lisa Simeone. What does it mean to find your voice? In a metaphorical sense, of course, it means discovering who you really are, what you believe, what values you hold most dear. But for some people, it can also have a literal meaning. There are people, for instance, who don't speak up about even simple things, who learn to do that with great difficulty over time. They're almost afraid of hearing their own voices. They have to force their breath to push through their throats, giving utterance to thoughts others might find dangerous or disturbing. It becomes a physical as well as psychological effort. And then there are people who sing. Talk about finding your voice in a bold way. Then you're really putting yourself out there. That's what happened to Vince Gabriel, a blues singer from Maine who found his voice by telling of his experiences in Vietnam, in song. Though his stories of war are 40 years old, they feel present and immediate, like perhaps the stories of soldiers returning from Iraq today. Vince Gabriel shares his memories in a program produced by Christina Antolini. It's called Vietnam Blues.
Vince Gabriel lives at the end of a wooded dirt road in Warren, Maine, in a trailer with a recording studio in its living room. He's better known to local residents as Blind Al, though Vince isn't actually blind, and Albert is his middle name. Blind Al is Vince's stage name when he performs in clubs and bars. He looks every inch the rock star, from his leather jacket to his many silver bracelets, down to his cowboy boots. And music fills almost every waking moment of Vince's life, between performing and producing all his own albums from this very studio.
I probably die with my hands on my mixing board, slumped over, my face up against one of the knobs, and that'll be the end of it. But I'll be happy anyway.
As Blind Al, Vince has become a successful musician, making a living for himself by playing his blend of blues and rock around Maine. But some of Vince's songs are not what you might normally expect in a crowded bar. Vince is a veteran of the Vietnam War's 1968 Tet Offensive, a former soldier in the United States Infantry. A couple of years ago, he found himself suddenly drawn to write songs about Vietnam. He recorded them as he wrote them, playing almost all parts, from drums to lead guitar to backup vocals. In a few weeks, he had completed an entire album recounting his experience of the war, from draft card to the present. Vince's story begins in the summer of 1967, just after he graduated from high school.
Letter came in the mail one day, said, "Boy, your government needs you now." Very bad, it raced through my brain. I try to make sense of mine. I knew my life would be forever changed. The thought of dying couldn't soothe my soul. God, I'm just a kid, I haven't even lived. Lord knows I don't wanna go.
I went on a vacation to California. I just took off by myself. And as I was in the process of getting stupid, one morning my father called me up at my uncle's house, which is where I was staying, and told me that I got a letter in the mail. And it didn't register. It didn't register to me what he was talking about. And so my big question was, well, okay, so why'd you call me about a letter? Why can't I wait till I get home? Because I just stopped dead in my tracks, and I said, I didn't get drafted, did I? He goes, yeah, you gotta come home, like, right now. So the next day, I was on a plane home, and it happened so fast. I was only home for a day and a half, and I had a report. And so my mom threw together this quick going-away party, and everybody showed up, and my band played in the garage, you know. And a couple days later, my butt was reporting for military service. From that point on, all of a sudden, Vietnam became really important to me.
I went through basic training. We all knew we were gonna go. They taught us all the finer points.
that an infantry soldier ought to know.
And what happened was I went through my infantry training, then I got sent home for 30 days, and it just happened to be Christmas. Christmas and New Year's, I was home with my family. Which is, I mean, I'm glad I was home for Christmas, but that's a tough one. When you spend the holidays like that with your family, and then the next thing you know, your butt's off to Vietnam, possibility of not coming back, you know, alive. So my family took me to, I guess it was Newark Airport. My grandmother and grandfather went, and all my sisters, my brother, my mother and father, and took me to the airport so that I could fly to San Francisco, and so I could go to Oakland and go to Vietnam. So I flew out to San Francisco, stayed in a Holiday Inn, couldn't go to the bar because I wasn't old enough to drink. I couldn't even get blasted just one time. So I stayed in my room by myself that night and just watched television. That was it. And then next morning I went to Oakland and waited for 3 days until they called our names to go. And I think it's got to feel like a guy who's condemned to die in prison. You know it's going to happen, but it doesn't really hit you until they're strapping your butt into this thing. It didn't really strike me until I was actually on that plane going. And even then, I don't think it really hit me until I got off the plane and landed in Vietnam and realized where the hell I was. Because the first thing I heard was explosions. And then they put us in this bus with mesh wire over the window so that, you know, Viet Cong couldn't throw hand grenades through them. Then I realized I wasn't in New Jersey anymore. But the saddest part about arriving in Vietnam was when you got off of the plane, you walked right by a line of guys waiting to get back on that plane to go home. And so it was like, if I could just sneak back in this line, you know, and get on that plane, man, and get back home and just go back to being a teenager again. Designated point men, which is basically a scout. And there's actually three of them up front. You are maybe 100 yards ahead of the rest of the troops, you know, that are walking through the jungle or the rice paddies or whatever. Basically, what your job is to go through everything first to make sure it's safe for everybody else. And that's, and I carried a radio on my back, which is not. The combination of being a point man and having a radio on your back is not a good combination, because really one of the first things that the Viet Cong used to try to do was cut off the communication. And so here I am, fairly tall to begin with this big antenna sticking up, you know, like put a flag on here saying, here I am, you know, with an arrow pointing down at me.
Each and every morning the choppers come, they pick us up and drop us in the jungle.
Going out in the jungle every day was kind of like a 9-to-5 job. It was a daytime activity. In the morning, helicopters would come and pick us up, and they'd take us out to wherever they were going to take us. And I would automatically walk up front to walk point with my two buddies, and we would be given maps and told to walk to a certain, we were going to a certain destination. And depending on whether it was rice paddies or jungle, it could take hours and hours to walk 3 miles because you're walking through such thick jungle growth. And we had, our other job was, we had a machete through the jungle to clear a path for everybody else. The thing was, you never knew when you were going to run into Viet Cong, so And then there were other things aside from being a combi. You had to watch out for booby traps, punji pits, which are big holes with sharp bamboo sticks stuck in the ground. And then there were landmines, and I mean, it was all kinds of stuff. All kinds of stuff there.
11 Bravo, that's what we were. Light weapons, infantry, we walked across the nation. Lived in a hole down in the ground. Bathed in a helmet, no, this was not vacation.
The whole war was strange because there weren't any front lines where you could say everything from here back is ours and everything from here forwards is theirs. We were in like different locations, and we'd take a hill after two or three days of fighting, and we'd stay there for maybe a day or two, or maybe we wouldn't stay there at all, and we'd leave it alone, and a couple days later, a week later, the Viet Cong were back again. I mean, North Vietnamese were back on the hill again. We're all thinking, what kind of war is this, you know? We go there, we get these guys killed and injured and everything, and then we just kind of give it back to them. My goal was to make it through the day alive. I didn't even think about walking because there was so much of it to do, that what I did was I just concentrated on one step at a time when I was walking. That's how I could get through it. Because if I stopped and thought about how far we had to walk, it would have been a tough one. So I got myself in this mindset after a while, or actually really quick, that I was just mentally concentrate on moving my legs. Just one step, and the next step, and the next step. That's what I did. Part of the time I was over there, I had acquired a guitar from somewhere. I don't know where it was. It was a piece of junk, but it was the only instrument that I had. And a buddy of mine also had one. So we'd sit out in the jungle, and at night we'd sit out and we'd play any song that we could think of, even songs we didn't like. I mean, just to play. So that's what I did. I mean, I carried that guitar all through Vietnam. I carried it in the jungle with me on helicopters everywhere. I mean, wherever all my gear went, my rifle and everything, the guitar went too. Being in combat, first of all, the first thing you notice is your adrenaline just kicks right in, because every sense in your body just wakes up. You're aware of everything, sight, smell, everything. I remember what a combat smelled like gunpowder and diesel fuel from tanks and stuff, and hearing helicopters. I mean, whenever I hear a helicopter now, man, I'm right back there again, you know. It's like that sound is so connected with Vietnam, because we flew in helicopters and they took us out in the jungle and they dropped us off and they picked us up, and helicopters were flying all over the place anyway. There was the smell of the dirt, there was the humidity, everything you could feel and smell and see became like magnified 100 times.
I can still hear the ringing in my ears. AK-47s everywhere. I was pinned down flat and I was scared. 1968, Happy New Year.
I went through this period of time where I wanted to get shot. I didn't want to get killed, but I wanted to get shot so I could get out of there. And that lasted for a little while. And then I went through this other phase where it's like, well, I don't really want to get shot. I want to fall and break my leg or something and get out of here. And then I went through a period of time where I didn't care if I got killed or not. I just got into this mindset where I was just so worn down from every day going out in the jungle that you just became numb. And I just, for a while, I didn't care. I didn't care whether I got killed or not. Thank you. Spitzer. Spitzer was a tall, skinny guy, good sense of humor, good guy, walked point with me and another guy who we called a winemaker.
Now Spitzer and the winemaker were men I once knew. We all walked the point in a land called the Knob. All of us hated it, we always complained. But when the choppers would drop us, we'd walk point again.
I carried an M16, and I guess there were three of us carrying M16s that day. So they told me not to walk point that day. And they grabbed my buddy Spitzer, who carried a M79 grenade launcher, which is basically looks like a sawed-off shotgun, one barrel, that shoots grenades, is what it does. So because they wanted a variety of different weapons up there, they put him in my place that day. And I walked what they call flank position. And so I was guarding the flank. I guess it was on the right side and back.
Now Spitzer and the winemaker were up in the lead. Too many 16s that told me to leave. Now Spitzer's in my place, the winemaker his. And I'm hanging back in the file with the kids.
We walked through the jungle, or rice paddies, or wherever we were walking. And I guess around 12 o'clock we stopped to eat. Right before we were finished eating, they had the point squad move out ahead of us because they were supposed to be like 200 yards ahead of us anyway. What they did was they walked into a minefield that was marked and they didn't see it. At least that's what I was told. While we were eating, I heard this giant explosion up front, and I knew my buddy was up there, but we couldn't get up to where they were because they were in the minefield. But I found out it was my buddy Spitzer who was stepped on a booby trap and it killed him. Just blew him right up.
Now I heard the bomb go off, was way up ahead. The winemaker's bleeding and Spitzer is dead. I carry him with me, the guilt, blame, and all. Why am I here? And his name's on the wall.
The first feeling I got when I heard who it was, my whole spine just went numb. And then I remember I carried some of his gear back. It was just covered with blood. It's funny, you know, you think, thank God it wasn't me, but then, you know, on the other side of that, I didn't want him to die, you know, and it's like you're thinking these two things at the same time, which go against each other. It's a very complicated thought process. But, you know, the thing about it is in Vietnam, you can't dwell on this stuff, because if you do, your senses will be put on vacation for a little while because your mind is on somewhere else thinking about something like that, and you could be killed any minute. He never leaves my mind. I never forget it. I think after about 7 or 8 months, I went on R&R, which was to Bangkok, Thailand, which was a lot of fun. And it's a cruel joke to be playing too on you, because you're in war. The next day you're on R&R, like you're in Florida somewhere. You know, in the clubs, all the girls and everything, and having a good time, and you're drinking, and now you're not in war anymore. You're in Bangkok, Thailand, like you're back in the States partying, you know, for 5 days. And you're just starting to get used to it about the fifth day, and then you got to go back, and go back to war.
The ground is cold, wet from raining, it brings me back to where I am.
So when I came back from R&R, the guys that were in my company were coming up to me and saying, hey man, you're getting out of here. Of course, I didn't believe a word anybody was saying to me about that, because it was too good to be true, because that meant I wasn't going to be in combat anymore. But then when a sergeant came up to me and told me to pack my stuff, I was leaving, then I finally realized that something was going on. So the deal was, we were being shipped out of the jungle. Don't know why we got chosen. Still don't. It was like I prayed and my prayers were answered. It was like, special delivery from Mr. Gabriel. Guess what? We have answered your prayer. Your ass is getting out of the jungle. I wrote my memoirs. Just wrote anything I could think of that popped up in my mind about every aspect of Vietnam that I went through. And I wrote about coming home. Coming home. I didn't tell my mother and father exactly when I was coming home. Thought I'd surprise them. I called my grandfather and grandmother and asked them if they would pick me up and drive me to my parents' house. We arrived at my parents' house in the afternoon. They had no idea I was about to knock on their front door. I got out of my grandfather's car and snuck up to the front door and knocked. There were long panes of windows on each side of the door, and as my sister came to the stairs to answer the door, she saw the arm of my dress greens and yelled out, "Vinny's home." I didn't cry. I don't know why. I should have. This was the happiest day of my life, and I kept all that emotion inside. Men don't cry. Thinking back now, I wish I could have let it all out when my sister opened that door. This is harder. Excuse me. Okay. I love my family more than words or actions can ever say or show. It's a love that will go on long after I'm dead and gone. I can't read anymore. I think when I got back, I was just so happy to be alive and that I was home with my family and that I could play rock and roll music again that I didn't think about anything else. It's like being held underwater for 4 minutes and with not much air left, and then all of a sudden being allowed to just pop up to the surface and breathe again. That's kind of like what it felt like for me to be home. So I didn't need a celebration. I was my own celebration. But after a number of years passed and I started to give, you know, being in Vietnam more thought and really actually realize that nobody did welcome us home, I started to think a little more seriously about that. Was it right we weren't given a welcome home? No, it wasn't right. Was it right people spit on us and called us baby killers? No, that wasn't right either. And it wasn't right that they weren't behind the troops because they didn't understand the war. Hey, we didn't understand the war. We were over there. And, you know, the people here just thought they were doing what was right, protesting the war. And hey, man, I was all for ending the war, man. You know, like, let's get this thing over with because what are we doing? But I reserve the right to not say whether it was worth it or not, because of all the guys that were killed over there, I mean, I can't say that it wasn't worth it. I mean, and that every one of those guys died in vain. You know, you go to Iraq now, these guys are just like we were. They're over there scared shitless, getting shot and killed and arms and legs blown off and not coming back to see their family again. They're going through the same thing we went through, except now the people are behind them. They might not be behind the government, but they're behind the troops. And that's just what they need, man. They need some support. And we didn't have that. To look back, I'm very proud that I was in Vietnam. I served with a lot of really great people from all over the United States. Basically did what I did. We just went. And we were called up and we went and we served, and maybe we didn't want to go and we were scared to death and afraid of dying, but we still went.
I still try to find an answer. The dead have not died in vain. And try not to sweep it under, to separate hate from pain. I still sit and
lot of guys have a guilty feeling about the fact that they made it back alive and their buddy didn't, or their buddies didn't, or other guys they didn't even know didn't make it back. And for the longest time, you know, I was like engulfed with this thought of why I'm here. I mean, really, why am I here? I didn't know, and I still don't know for sure. But the only thing I can do is play music. My passion and what's in my heart is music. And, you know, if somebody asks you a question about why you think you're here, I gotta give an answer. And that's my answer, is to play music.
I still dream and see their faces.
Vietnam Blues was produced and edited by Tina Antolini with assistance from Rebecca Miller, Karen Brown, and the Advanced Media Center at Hampshire College. If you enjoyed Vince's music and you'd like to hear some more, visit us online at soundprint.org. At the bottom of the page is a link to contact us. We can let you know how to get a copy of the soundtrack, which is called 11 Bravo Vietnam. You can also re-listen to all of our programs online. That address, again, is soundprint.org. Soundprint is produced by the Soundprint Media Center in association with WAMU and American University. Radio may seem like one-way communication, but you can give us feedback by sending an email to talkback@soundprint.org. Soundprint episodes are available on CD for a small fee. Give us a call at 1-888-38-TAPES and we'll send you your favorite episodes. That number again is 1-888-38-TAPES. Or you can order online at soundprint.org. Soundprint is production assistant Nkechi Mogekwu and audio engineer Jared Weisbrot. Our executive producer is Moira Rankin. I'm Lisa Simeone.